He beats his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the second chapter in the It franchise. It's called It Chapter 2.
No.
Oh, and sees the return of Pennywise and the adult version of the Losers Club 27 years after the events of the first movie, which is confusingly just called It and not It Chapter 1. Honestly, they need to get with the program on that one. Anywho, over the next hour or so, we will be taking your questions, listeners' questions about the movie, and we will be discussing it in great detail. This is a spoiler special podcast. So if you have not seen It Chapter 2, then stop listening. Honestly, what are you doing? Ridiculous. But if you have seen It Chapter 2, then you'll be delighted to know that I'm joined by our very own Losers Club.
Oh.
Yay.
It's a compliment. It's a compliment. Losers Club are a wonderful group of people.
Yeah, they are.
Wonderful group of people. We're joined by our geek queen, Helen O'Hara. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. I've mostly recovered from the trauma of watching this film.
Scary film.
Scary film.
Your hair is winter fire.
January embers.
My heart burns there too.
Aww, he's so
that's
cute.
Nice. That's very, very good. We're also joined by Ben Travis, as you've heard. Hey!
What?
A Ben! We have a Ben.
Whoa.
I am also ripped, extraordinarily ripped, in a way that you possibly wouldn't expect.
Yep, I've often said this about you, Ben. You are ripped and cut.
Mm-hmm. Shredded.
Even. Shredded, in fact, yes. You have abs that you could, you know, grill a waffle on.
Can you do that? A clown with? Can you, wait, you don't punch
you've got,
with abs,
you've got clown
you?
Punching abs. Mm. Ben, I would say you're not just penny wise, you're pound foolish, and I'm delighted that you're here. Very exciting times. Thanks. But before you hear the three of us giggling idiots talk about this movie in great detail, let's hear from the two non-giggly non-idiots who made the movie. And that's the brother-sister directing producing team, Andy and Barbara Muschietti. I spoke to them last week in a London hotel room and got into a lot of stuff about this movie. Not everything, because we only had 25 minutes and this is a movie, in case you haven't checked, that's nearly 3 hours long, so there's a lot of stuff that we didn't get around to talking about, but I think we covered a lot of the major bases. So here we go. Me talking to the Muschiettis. Enjoy. I'm delighted to be joined in this very special spoiler special for It Chapter 2 by the director Andy Muschietti and producer Barbara Muschietti. How are you both?
We're great.
Good.
Not jet lagged. Oh, I'm jet lagged.
Me too.
I just feel
where
in a state.
Where are you coming from?
I just came from Camden, but I just feel jet lagged. It's just my natural state.
Empathy pains.
Precisely. But yeah, I want to start with, I always start these spoiler specials with a big question that's in everybody's lips. Peter Bogdanovich.
Yeah.
What's going on? How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I became friends with Peter through my very good friend and mutual friend, Axel Kuchevaski. Mm-hmm. He's Argentinian, but, you know, he's a huge movie buff. Axel knew that one of my favorite movies was Paper Moon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so he invited me to a dinner with Bogdanovich, and I was like, what? No. How can, no, I'm too nervous to meet Peter Bogdanovich. And it just went, and we had like a wonderful, you know, dinner together. He's obviously like an encyclopedia of
yep.
film. And
yep.
He's very, you know, willing to talk about his experiences, and he has a great sense of humor. So it was great. And then we did it again and again. Barbara started crashing those dinners. And one day Peter told me, hey, you don't happen to have a role for an old director, do you?
Well, it just
and
so happens.
Like, well, it happens as it happens. I have a actually, it's a set. Yeah, I do. It's a scene with a movie set. Well, one of the characters, Bill Tembro, Stuttering Bill, Big Bill, just goes, you know, with his he's writing the screenplay of the movie, which is actually an adaptation of his own book.
Yes.
And you know, and he gets some shit from the director, and that
yeah.
director is called Peter, and that's him.
Yeah, he did a great job. He's not only a great director and an actor, but
yeah.
he's also a director whisperer. because all of his conversations happen very close to your ear.
Oh, really?
Yes, and he has a very soft voice. And, you know, he had Orson Welles living in his house. All the stories start like that. And it's like, where am I? It's amazing.
That's cameo number one I wanted to talk about.
Cameo number one. Of course, the scene grew a lot when he signed.
In,
and we'll just like make the part a little more substantial. And it's really funny, you know. It ends up being every one of these cameos ends up being a longer scene and somehow a comedy.
Well, comedy is one thing I want to talk about as well, because there's a lovely balance of comedy and horror in this movie at certain points. But before we get on to that, let's talk about Mr. King as well, because. This isn't just an author cameo. He gets a scene. He gets to act alongside, you know, his creation, Bill Denbrough, which must have blown his mind, I can imagine. How did that come about?
Yeah, I think he was thrilled, you know, that I asked, and he said, "Well, you have to have in mind that I'm a bit of a jinx. All the movies I was in just bombed. You have to know this before." And I'm like, I wouldn't worry about this. And if it, like, you know, if it's, this is true, let's like just like,
well, you know who to blame, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's not gonna happen, but you just go straight to King and go, it's your fault.
So in Argentina, we're somehow superstitious. So you know, every time that bad luck is mentioned or something that brings bad luck appears, you can conjure it by touching your left nut with your right hand.
The Italians do it too. From the Italians.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's just like you just lift the curse with that, just touching your left nut. So when Stephen wrote me that, I just touched my left nut and said, "It's going to be fine, Steve. We're going to do good."
Yeah.
And
I let the record show, Andy just did it again. Just to let the record state.
Oh my God! I didn't even notice that I was doing it.
It was just a subconscious thing. It's just one of those things. But he's great, and it comes in the middle of a run of scenes where the main characters are being beset by Pennywise and are being beset by by ghoulish apparitions. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really interesting scene because you're on edge, thinking, is King one of these apparitions as well? But you play it quite straight, and actually it's really lovely that he's the guy who sells silver back to Bill Denbrough.
Yeah, well, that's the great thing of, you know, infusing some humor in a, you know, horror drama, which is people don't know what they're going to get at the end of the scene. And that's part of the whole unpredictability of the narrative. Yeah. And that's great, because people are on the edge of the seats. Apart from because of the story or where the story is going, it's they don't know whether if they're going to get a joke or a chopped of arm at the end of it.
sometimes both.
You know, when we start watching the movie with people, we realize people get triggered by things that we hadn't even thought about that were not planned.
Okay, such as?
Do you want to go into the quarry, for instance?
No, there's a scene like in the quarry in the first movie when you know, like, the kids are bonding and for the first time, like, Beverly is part of this group for the first time, and they're sort of like playing and splashing around the water. At the end of that scene, something touches Richie's foot underwater, and they all look down, and it's like, what is that? Mm. It's a turtle. It's a turtle. And they all submerge. They all go down under the water, and the camera goes into the water, and it's a veiled green screen for a while, and people are on their on the edge of the seat there for some reason that I wasn't I didn't calculate at all. It was like an edit thing, you know. It's an edit thing that wasn't calculated. And the next thing we know, we cut to the stereo machine blasting.
It's about expectations, I guess. People are conditioned to expect something. Oh. Even at the end, for example, after Pennywise has been banished, even that last moment in the lake where they're swimming, as an audience, you're almost conditioned to expect one last shock, one last something rising from the dead. It's really interesting.
At that point, it's all joy.
It's all just taking
friendship.
It easy. Yeah.
No, it's really interesting. And going back to this idea of balancing comedy and horror and finding comedy in unexpected places in this movie as well. For example, the sequence where Bowers stabs Eddie. Yeah. That's a really funny sequence.
And it's very grotesque. And it's very violent. There's a lot of blood. And Eddie's a beloved character. You don't know if he's going to get out alive of that one.
Yeah.
And still, it's funny. You know, it's I love that scene.
And is that from a directing point of view? Mm-hmm. Is that something that you engineer deliberately? Is that something that is based around the performances? You know, James Ranson is really funny in this movie, for example.
I think I deliberately wanted a little texture of what Eddie always is, which is like neurotic and awkward. So just like going dramatic, and that scene would have been like forced, I think. Mm. So there was like some level of humor that had to be. And when James started doing it, I started like laughing my ass off, because what he does is so unique in that scene. You know, he's trying to starve him. He has a knife buried in his face, and he starts still having a conversation with Henry, who says, he told me to do that. Well, who told you that? I got excited, so I told him, you know, okay, you're gonna go back into the bathtub, and you're gonna close the curtain, you know, like this weird ridiculous mechanism of survival in which you think that just by hiding you're gonna
if he can't see me,
save yourself. And just the idea is ridiculous, you know, but it's pathetic. It's like, it reminds me of, I mean, these things always come from something that you experienced or you saw at one point in your life. And I remember in Stanley Kubrick's Lolita, Peter Sellers, trying, you know, to avoid getting killed by James Mason, I think it was. And he does a similar thing. He just tries to divert the situation with humor, and then he hides himself behind a huge picture frame, painting that is lying on the wall.
Yeah.
And he just hides there, and then he gets like murdered.
Yes. You go slightly in a different direction than this one.
Yeah, and I was thinking of that scene, and I first came up with the scene, and then I remember where that sort of reference,
But such a lovely twist on it, and again, there's other things as well where you lean into the influences of it towards the end as the head of young Stan. Sprouts spider legs immediately. As a horror fan, you're thinking, oh, this, I've seen this before, this feels a little bit like the thing. And then you lean into it, you really do lean into it, not only by replicating that shot,
well, that happened in
having that line, you know,
on the day, because, you know, like, the spider didn't necessarily come from the thing, the spider itself, like, you know, the legs coming out of it just didn't, or not consciously at least. And we were with, you know, Bill Hader and I were there, and I think I should say something here. And I'm like, well, why don't we just in the thing, right?
Yeah.
And the guy looks at the spider. Well, what was it? And so he's like, oh, yeah. You got to be fucking kidding me. That's what he said, right? So we confirmed that was it. What it is. And he just said it. And we had a lot of fun. You know, those things are not calculated, but, you know, they just come up on the day, and
oh man,
and it's great. And and Bill Hader is a great, as a huge you know, film buff.
And oh god, and he's a laughing cue. He's a human laughing cue. And when we see the film with people, they start laughing and relaxing the second he gets on screen, which is, I've never seen that ever.
He's an enormously likable presence. Yeah. It's great. He's a very reassuring figure, even when he's panicking and screaming. There's so much to get into. I mean, this is a film that's nearly 3 hours long, based on a book that's 1,400 pages. Well, 245. That's nearly 3 hours, Barbara. But it's based on a book that's fairly lengthy, as I recall, and so much to get into. And there are some interesting changes as well from the book. I don't know whether you can both speak about those. For example, Audra doesn't play as big a role in the book. Neither does Bev's husband. Was that something that was in there initially? The idea that Pennywise, because he brings Bowers as to the town as a surrogate.
Yeah.
Was there an idea that Audra and Tom were in the film for a while as well?
I considered Audra and Tom like returning, but you know, it was too much diversion from the main plot. I think the story in the book suffers from that, from you know, too many plot like subplots happening at the same time. And even if it's not a bad thing on the book, and you still like you know sort of get you know dragged in the tension of those storylines, it's not a good idea for a film narrative, for a film you know language where everything has to be like a little more consequential. You can't like you know really like spend a lot of time on subplots that people eventually will not care about because they are a lesser threat. And it sort of happened, you know, this is probably something that I learned from experience in the first movie, in chapter one. As interesting as Henry Bowers' character is as a kid, and he's a bully, and he's like a threat, like a physical, like real, present and real danger for the losers. Mm-hmm. Whenever we spend time with Bowers at home, trying to humanize him or trying to explain why he's like that or like the trauma from, you know, having an abusive father who was a cop, people didn't care.
Oh, really?
People did not care and they showed it. You know, test screenings, they were like, yeah, Bowers, we don't care about Bowers. Well, it's not that they didn't care about Bowers. It's just like the time that we spent away from the losers and the story moving forward, so it ends up being you know I didn't want to repeat that.
This is where the focus is, as well. And from an antagonistic standpoint as well, Pennywise is the villain of the story.
It's the master.
Yes,
yeah. You know. So anything that distracts from that propulsion. Is going to annoy people at some point of the movie. And of course, this is such... If we had two characters instead of seven, you know, of course, subplots would be more welcome. But we had seven full stories that we had to cover. So it was tricky. And there's, you know, the book has... You know, the Stanley Uris, Patty Uris episode... Mm-hmm. You know, chapter, I'm sorry, about, you know... About them not having children and their life in Atlanta and her desire to, you know, be part of the country club, but being Jewish. It is, you know, from the literary standpoint, it's so wonderful and it's such a great read, but it's almost impossible to put in this adaptation. You can just hint at it.
And you've talked in the past about, you know, the changing what happens to Mike in the book as well. For this movie, was that important to you as well?
There's changes that come from.
They're not happy about it. the cops.
All these changes come from the translation that you do from you know a literary narrative to a film, you know, narrative, where you basically have to make all the events consequential. You have to crank up the tension all the time, and make it, you know, live almost in a real time, you know, to just make it a great film experience. In the book, the purpose of Mike's investigation is not too clear. Of course, he's like, you know, invested in finding out about the story of Pennywise and it, and he like interviews all these people. In the movie, he has a clear purpose of trying to find the weapon that you can destroy it with. So he reaches a dead end, you know, like by interviewing all the people of town, like reading everything that was written about the history of Derry, and he eventually finds a alleged weapon in a ritual that the Native the Native community that used to live in Derry had, you know, forged, and he uses that, and it's the ritual of Chud. The ritual of Chud is in the book is something that the kids discover, that Bill discovered by reading. But this is something that I was, you know, everything has a function in this movie, and the ritual of Chud has, you know, so Mike first, he has a very like determined purpose of finding the weapon to kill Pennywise. And when he finally reaches a dead end, he decides to use the only weapon that he knows that can work. And that weapon is the power of belief.
Yeah.
Now, the losers are not kids anymore. So in the logic of this world, adults don't have that power.
Yeah.
And they don't have the power of unified belief, which is actually the only thing that works. As he witnessed, like in 1989, when they were in the cistern, and all the kids thought that stun bolt was loaded, and Mike was the only one who knew that it was not loaded, and he keeps repeating, "It's not loaded, it's not loaded," and all the kids are like, "Kill it, kill it, kill it, kill it." And the result of that is that there's a stumble fires, and they end up drawing a hole in Pennywise's forehead.
Yeah.
So Ritual of Chud is the only thing that Mike can bring to make these people believe again. It's a lie.
Yeah. And there are interesting
spoiler alert.
it's a spoiler special as well. There are interesting stumbles along the way also, and as Mike maybe overpromises a little bit about what the ritual can do or about his faith in the ritual. And I thought that was an interesting wrinkle as well. Yeah,
he doesn't know what he knows is that if they don't do something, it will happen again. So and it is happening again.
Yeah.
And that's what he's been waiting for 27 years.
Just to go right to the idea of the very end of the film as well. I mean, Pennywise can represent a whole manner of things to a whole manner of people in different ways. Looking at a movie in this day and age is very, very hard for me to get the idea of Trump and trolls on the internet and incels and all that sort of stuff out of my head. You have this idea where at the end of the film where people come together for noble purpose and take the power away from a figure of evil. Now, are you influenced by current day events when you're thinking about that?
How can you not be?
Yeah.
You know, and there's something that, you know, yeah, we can talk about world leaders and many other things, but I think what is incredibly important, and it's something that at least for me, it took me a long time to associate with the book. I certainly did not read it like that when I was 15, but it's, you know, apathy.
Yeah.
Which in the book is reflected as the forgetfulness, this fog that, you know, basically stands over Derry and everybody forgets. And that's apathy.
Yeah.
That's what happens when we just pretend things are not happening and we don't fight the people that are trying to divide us and scare us.
Yeah, you know, it's a definitely, you know, I probably Stephen King had in mind, you know, this as an analogy of the times that were happening, because, you know, the use of fear as a tool to control and divide, it's not something new. Now it reached like obscene levels.
Yeah,
where you like see it in the, it's like so like
evident
and obscene that it's like, how are not people like just like revolting against this more? You know, so I like to, you know, to use this movie as an analogy of what like living in a culture of fear where like, you know, a monster can use. Fear is a weapon to, you know, just divide its victims and turn them against each other, you know?
It is a global trend. It's nothing. You
know, of course.
We cannot keep it to one continent.
No, true. Believe me, it's as pertinent here as it is anywhere else. The beginning of the movie has the attack on the gay couple, which is from the book as well.
Yeah.
But did you consider changing the circumstances of that, given that this takes place largely in the present day, were you concerned about potential pushback on that from audiences in terms of an attack on a gay couple?
No, because it's I think it's like, you know, a story that talks about, you know, the darkness in human behavior, and bigotry and homophobia, which are things that are still like going on. And so it's a story that regardless of the supernatural monster that lives in this world, Stephen King is making a comment about like the horrible like behavior that within you know these communities in the middle of like America and small town America, especially in these days, like leaving like all these things apart would be like a little like, you know, like omitting something that is horrible that is going on right now in our society.
Yeah, it almost feels as well that in some way, Pennywise, or that apathy you were talking about, Barbara, has infected and infested those attackers at the beginning of the movie. And then just very, very quickly, one last thing. There's a lovely thread throughout the movie where Bill keeps being ripped by people about how he sucks at endings and how his endings don't work. And whenever you put that into a movie, you guys must have been really working hard making sure your ending didn't suck. So how did you go about that? Nah, how hard did you work on that? How many iterations did it go through?
I was never like worried. Of course, when you're building the story and you're working with the screenwriters, you're always concerned about the ending and make it an ending that is consistent with the journeys and, you know, the struggles of the characters and the final confrontation and the outcome of that. But I felt confident. I always felt confident about the ending, especially because
You felt confident when you found it.
Did it take a while to find?
Yeah.
In terms of the ending, the final showdown with Pennywise, or what comes afterwards?
No, I was pretty sure that I wanted an ending that was an intimate resolution. That, you know, was a payoff of those, like, the emotional journeys and struggles of the characters, you know, unlike the book, which totally has that, but also, like, it lives in a bigger, like, you know, overblown destruction of the city of Derry.
Yes. Yep.
I didn't want to, distract from the emotional conclusion that I wanted, you know, so it's about, like, the feelings. So the ending in this movie lives in the feelings of the characters more, and into a huge spectacle of destruction. So no, I wasn't like totally. I don't think I was like worried about like not delivering a good ending. Even though I was criticized by the ending of Mama, which I still, you know, because you were there. a lot of people hate the ending of Obama, and I see it in perspective now, and it's like, okay, that there's people that hate it doesn't mean that it's not good or it's not consistent, you know. Yeah. I think that the ending of Mama was the mistake that they probably like blamed me for is that it's like a little bit of humanizing the monster. So it's a monster movie.
Yeah.
And at the end, instead of like destroying the monster, you just humanize it and let her actually like get away with killing a child,
which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, I thought so too.
She doesn't die. She doesn't die. I still believe that she doesn't die.
So I think it was frustrating for a lot of people that wanted to see like Mama destroyed, which would be like the norm.
Yeah, true.
In movies like that, and also I guess that some people also like, you know, resented the use of CG, I guess. I don't know. I'm done with that.
People will nitpick anything, Andy, honestly. But it's been really fun talking to you guys again, both for an It Chapter 2 spoiler special and a Mama spoiler special as well, right there at the end. Just snuck it in. I liked it. That was fun. Andy, Barbara, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so that was Andy Muschietti and Barbara Muschietti, and I think they enjoyed that. I think they enjoyed the spoiler special, the spoiler therapy, as Ryan Reynolds once dubbed it, of being able to unburden themselves of all the things they haven't been able to talk about for the last 2 years or so whilst making this movie. And we should say before we begin that we didn't do a spoiler special for the first It, largely because I don't think they were in the Muschiettis were in, and we'd like to have filmmaker conversations for these spoiler specials. But maybe also because It took everyone by surprise, the first one, in that it became something of a phenomenon in a way, weird way.
Yeah, we certainly all liked it, I think.
Yeah, I really liked it. It's one of those films that for me, I think if you ask me, oh, what are the best films of the last couple of years? It's not something that would immediately jump out. But the more I think about it, it's so, I think it's incredibly well made and very well done. But at the same time, it's so supremely entertaining. I really, really like the first It.
Yeah,
probably more than this one, actually, which I'm sure we'll get into. But
yeah, that's fair. I think it did that. I think it was around the time that everybody was going nuts for Stranger Things, and I was not on the Stranger Things bandwagon. I was really a little bit underwhelmed by it at first.
I still haven't seen a single episode.
I mean, it's fine, but this got me much more than that did. It was like everything that everybody's saying about Stranger Things, I think, is true of It. I think it has that nostalgia. It has that. That kick that you wanted, it has that Stephen Kinginess, obviously, that Stranger Things aspired to, and it just had great performances from those kids, and it just looked so stylish as well. I mean, that Pennywise instantly for me overtook the Tim Curry
really?
Version. Yeah,
interesting.
So it was. I thought it was just enormously effective, and I just thought as well, splitting up the time periods was something that worked really, really well.
That's really interesting because. There was a danger that it might have had John Carter syndrome in that it comes along after the thing that it inspired.
Have riffed, everybody's riffed on it.
Everyone's riffed on it and it's huge. It goes gangbusters and then that comes along and everyone's like, I've seen this.
Yeah.
So there was a chance that maybe people, in fact, legitimately, there might be people who are going, what's this Stranger Things knockoff that I'm seeing in cinemas?
Yeah, I'm sure there are a few of those because I think, you know, again, that's been such a phenomenon. But, I mean, this is one of Stephen King's biggest hits of the 80s. Again, it's probably not my favourite King book. That would be probably Salem's Lot or The Stand, actually. I think those are phenomenal books. But, again, he's so good at making a town come to life. He's so good at a community. He's a writer of such detail and such texture. And I felt like this film and the last one got that texture right. So even when, you know, there wasn't an obviously scary thing happening, it had that texture, it had those character beats, it had those little moments between terrifying incidents that kind of kept you interested.
For me, that's what it is. It's the characters. Mm. Like, I watch a lot of horror stuff. I feel like I'm fairly desensitized. I don't find either of these films particularly scary, but especially in the first film, the thing I was scared for was something bad happening to these characters because you just like them instantly. And I think between the writing and especially the performances of the kids and then the way that those characters are then caught up with in chapter 2 years later, I think they do an incredible job of kind of matching up the 27 years later cast. The characters in this are so strong and they are so well defined and each very distinct, but also extremely believable of coming from this kind of small town American background. I really cared about them. I really cared, which makes some of the stuff that comes in chapter two pretty heartbreaking. I was more sad than scared by chapter two, but that's not a criticism. I just, where it goes hit me hard.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I love It, although I haven't reread it in a long, long time because it's daunting, guys.
It is, and it's like there are things in the book that I don't enjoy. I mean, the whole running joke about problems with the ending. I have huge problems.
I mean,
there's
that thing that happens. Get lost in the. Yeah.
And it was a super good idea for It Chapter 1 to not do that.
Super good.
That was a super brilliant idea that is a massive improvement on the book to not have a group sex scene with your teenage protagonists. I think that's I think we can all agree that was an improvement.
Oh, I was talking about something completely different.
I know. The other bit with the ending with the whole cosmic turtle and stuff,
that
I'm also okay with them not doing that.
I don't know if it's good enough for Terry Pratchett.
Look, Cosmic Turtles are Terry Pratchett's thing, and I'm not having Stephen King.
Technically speaking, King got there first.
I'm not sure he did.
I think he did.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I think I have maths on my side with that one. But yeah, there was a little nod to it. Did you see there was in one of the scenes, there was a giant, well, not giant, but a fairly big statue of a turtle at one point. That's one of the things I know we're getting off characterization immediately, and we will start taking listeners' questions as how we're going to shape this particular podcast. But that's one of the things I really liked about this movie. I think, actually, I preferred this to it Chapter 1. Which, you know, I thought was a fine effort, a decent horror, and is really important in, along, I think, with the work that Jordan Peele is doing, of making horror more commercial and to allow horror to burst out of this niche that it's in. You know, it's great that we have all these elevated horror movies, these psychological horror movies of recent years, the likes of, you know, of It Follows and The Witch and whatnot, and Midsommar and the work of Ari Aster, but these aren't busting any blocks, whereas this felt like a phenomenon, and that's why I thought the first movie was important, but I preferred this one because of what it did. I thought the characterization, what it did, some of the risks it took with the characterizations were interesting, but I also like how batshit insane this one is. I mean, it really, apart from the omission of Maturin, the cosmic turtle, it goes for it. It doesn't, because it goes really early as well. I said, they're doing the ritual of Chud. Oh, okay. Oh, they've gone. Oh, they're fully going for it is a space alien.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. They're going for that because, you know, King was making the shit up as he went, pretty much as far as my understanding of it goes.
Yeah.
So they had leeway there to maybe change it, maybe go, actually, no, there's more of a demonic thing going on here. But no, this is full-blooded alien gobbledygook, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that was fun. The whole ritual thing and the, you know, it's not a million miles from an Indian burial ground, is it, in Pet Sematary? That felt a little bit overly familiar. That isn't in the book, really. The ritual is, but they have their own ritual in the book. Mm-hmm. If you remember, they inhale the smoke themselves. There's no sort of, oh, I went to the tribe outside town.
Yeah, all that stuff. Give Mike more things to do, I think.
Yeah, I think I might have preferred it if he hadn't involved other people, because that felt a little bit exploitative. But but otherwise, the ritual stuff was kind of weird and barmy. And of course, immediately fails and doesn't have the desired effect, which is always kind of fun when people have a great inspired idea of how it's going to all play out.
And I'm sure we'll get into this as well, but the ritual, or the version of the ritual here, gives this film its structure. It gives it its plot, the sort of driving thing of each member of the Losers Club having to go and find their sort of totem so that they can actually perform the ritual. Because I haven't read the book, but from what I understand in the book, it's different, that they just kind of all go back to town and it takes place over a slightly longer period of time.
There's a lot of changes in the book, yeah.
Whereas this gives them a reason. They've all come back to town because they said they would, but the ritual and the idea of having to find your totem and bring it back to do the ritual adds a bit more kind of drive to the narrative for this one.
It is interesting. Well, there are a number of changes in the book, some of which I miss, some of which I don't miss. But the idea of the totems is interesting. The idea that Bill Denbrough's totem is the boat that Georgie made the day that he got killed by Pennywise is interesting, because the movie, it almost seems like it's setting up the idea that Silver, the bike, is the totem.
Yeah.
How are you going to get a bike into that little container to burn it? I've no idea. So maybe that's why they decided to check this in it. But then again, you know, maybe the container can fit whatever you put into it. Who knows? Because Silver is such an important part of the book. And it is given its own very important scene here, where obviously Stephen King cameos, the significance of the bike is built up to the point where you think it's got to come into play. And how it comes to play in the book is really interesting, because Audra, Bill's wife, who is seen in one scene here, comes to Derry as well and is captured by Bev's husband, abusive husband, who has followed her back to Derry under the influence of Pennywise as well, who's basically saying, come to Derry, same way he controls Henry Bowers in this. And she falls into a catatonic trance, and to get her out of this trance at the end, after they've banished Pennywise, the chapter's called Bill Denbrough Beats the Devil Part 2, and he gets on Silver with her in the back and races down the streets of Derry, and something supernatural begins to happen. He starts to pick up speed, and the wind and everything begins to, and it wakes, it awakens her from her catatonic state. Mm. And that's how that's really important. Mm. And here, Silver just seems to be kind of jettisoned a little bit.
Yeah, I felt that scene played really oddly, just because it wasn't followed by anything else. And it's quite a long scene, actually, or a couple of scenes.
I really liked
really.
It.
I liked it a lot. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, Stephen King being in there, which was cool, and you were like, "Oh, this is awesome." But it didn't seem to go anywhere particularly afterwards, and I was a little bit disappointed. Like yourself, I thought that would play into the ritual. I thought that would have a role of some sort, and it just didn't. And also, I mean, Bev's abusive husband, that also felt thrown away. It felt like they were setting something up, that they were setting up a confrontation, a way for her to get free, and then they just didn't mention it again, and it's just what her new man is just going to take care of that. You know, that feels cheap in a way that this film generally does not. So I wanted her to take a little bit more power there, and a little bit more, because, you know, okay, there's the scene where she's walking out and she puts her wedding ring down, but I felt like he wasn't going to give up that easy, and it felt hurried and a little bit lame.
I think part of it is that scene, I mean, the film opens with two extremely brutal kind of scenes of abuse that are really horrifying to watch. They're more horrifying to watch than anything else in the rest of the film, or in either of the films, to be honest, especially obviously the homophobic attack at the start, which is very visceral. I can understand that would be very troubling for a lot of people to watch. And again, the scene with Bev and her husband, I mean, for me, not knowing where this story was going or what was going to happen with this, with the characters all grown up, I felt really kind of emotionally sideswiped by when you drop in on them all again and you see these very strong echoes of their childhoods in their adult life. Mm. And I think the main reason that Bev's maybe feels underplayed, like you said, that is she takes the ring off and then she's with Ben, but there's nothing. I think it's just because that opening attack is so horrendously brutal that it probably needed something at the end.
Yeah.
But things that I love, the slight change, I understand from the book that Eddie is now a risk analyst instead of I think he has a limo rental company in the book, and that Bill's wife looks a lot like Bev. She's got sort of a ginger bob haircut, and all these little sort of echoes through. And that scene where they each get their phone call and they each react in that different way with the car crash and throwing up, it's brilliant.
Mm. I thought the first hour of this movie was terrific. Yeah. I really did. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And the last hour, 45 minutes or so, is still very, very good and very, very effective and has some great, great scenes. But the first hour, I thought, okay, well, we're in for something truly special here, because they're taking their time with the characterizations, and they're just really, really likable actors.
Oh, yeah, they are.
I mean, they're so fucking good.
The Chinese restaurant scene
is so good.
You would just spend 3 hours with them hanging out and catching up, and
It's again, not that I keep banging this drum on the on spoiler specials, but it seems like one of those movies where you want to hang out with these people, and then custom dictates. I've said this before, but custom dictates that there has to be a plot, and there has to be a bad guy, and there has to be a thing for them to defeat. And I'd be more than happy to sit around with him. But
it's the Richard Linklater version where it's just like a hangout film.
Yeah,
and
Jim
Jarmusch
is it.
Oh my God, can you imagine the Richard Linklater It where he actually would have filmed the kids and then 27 years later he would have caught up with them?
But he would have required Bill Skarsgård to stay the same age the entire time. That's the level of dedication.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't put it past Bill Skarsgård. Somehow I feel that those Skarsgård, those genes are pretty damn good. Should we take some questions?
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm going to take them as best I can in the order in which they were sent. This is from Tez D. Joker 64. All the spookiness, all the scares. Oh, by the way, these are all Twitter, by the way. These are all people sliding into my DMs. All the spookiness, all the scares, all the mind fuckery. But can you answer why Pennywise's forehead is so huge?
Because it's full of all the ideas of how he's going to spook them. He has so many ideas of how every single person needs to be individually terrified.
Yep.
And that sort of inflates his large head.
I mean, I can't possibly argue with that. I mean, there's also a very long tradition of big foreheaded aliens in science fiction history, you know, going back to the very first episode of Star Trek ever. So I feel like that's part of a long and noble tradition of weirdos from outer space.
Like the leader. The leader's not an alien. yeah. from the Marvel comics, but he's still a bad one.
He's got that look, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. he does have that look.
It's why Regina George's hair is so big, because it's full of secrets.
Full of secrets.
Ah, there we go. Figured it out. Also because he's a big old spider dude. And spiders have massive,
what, so the legs?
Massive heads with loads of eyes.
Do they? I mean, loads of eyes, certainly.
That's where he keeps the legs.
Massive. What?
At Anxious Batman asks, don't know if this counts as a spoiler question or not, but what did you think of the reference to The Thing? I liked it at first, but thought Bill Hader's line was a step too far. Now, as people have heard, I asked the Muschietti's that, and it was kind of a weird bit of improv, actually, that they realised, oh, this looks like The Thing, so let's just roll with it.
Oh.
But I liked it. Mm. And there's a couple of moments later on, there's obviously the Shining reference, and there's a moment where Eddie and Richie, the camera is whipping past him. It reminded me a lot of a very specific shot in Evil Dead 2.
Evil Dead, yeah.
I think that, you know, Muschietti's really having a lot of fun with the end of this movie.
He's very much steeped in horror tradition, I think, in all those ways. I also think we should mention Bill Hader is freaking phenomenal in this film. He's so good. I didn't immediately pick up on the whole Richie being gay and closeted subtext at all, and people have said it's outright text, and so I feel very stupid.
I did have it written on my list of questions to ask the Muschiettis, and I didn't get around to it, even though we did discuss the opening attack.
Yeah,
I didn't discuss whether Richie is gay because he never overtly says it.
Yeah.
He never comes out. It's there to be picked up on, and maybe he even has feelings for Eddie as well.
Mm. Seems like.
But you know, the scratching the E into the wood at the end felt like, to me, that compounded with the Street Fighter arcade sequence. Yeah, I picked up on that straight away. That was to me, feels like text. Yeah, I guess it's never outright stated or defined, which in a way I think is quite a good thing in itself, that it doesn't need to be sort of defined or pinned down to one specific thing, but it's there as a part of his character.
Yeah. And he's just great in this role. I feel like people are sleeping on Bill Hader generally as an actor.
Well, he's fantastic. And if you don't watch Barry, then watch Barry, because Barry is tremendous. But if, interestingly enough, we did talk about the opening attack. The attack on the two gay guys at the beginning of the movie, that homophobic assault, because we have a colleague at Empire who had problems with that. He's a gay guy, and he had problems with that. And he had also problems with Pennywise referring to Richie's potentially closeted sexuality as his dirty little secret. It is interesting. It's an interesting thread that runs through the film.
Yeah, I think the opening attack is really upsetting, and I can see that might feel too upsetting, frankly, disproportionately upsetting for a lot of people, actually, in the audience. I mean, I think it's a way of just getting through to general audiences the way that Derry as a town and all its inhabitants have been twisted by this influence. I think it's a way of bringing home to people the idea that evil is not something that's unique to Derry, and it's something that affects us all. And I think, you know, I don't want to say it's justified for that reason, but I think that's certainly why it's there. I think justification is maybe something people can disagree on, and I absolutely know why our colleague would not agree. Yeah. But it is there for attempting to do something important and attempting to show us that there is real rot
corruption
in this town. Yeah,
it is carried over from the book.
Yeah,
the book, of course, the adult sections are set in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
This is set in, by and large, the present day, maybe 2017, 2016, 2017, around that. And given the current climate, you know, with racists and homophobes and misogynists rising to the top in society, which is terrifying, that it actually feels like something. In 1985, I think this is absolutely on point as well. I think I think King knows what he's doing. He's not doing this by accident. You know, it's about intolerance, clearly. And I think it hits home equally so today. It's more shocking today because it's still the sort of thing you don't think would happen today, but it absolutely would and does.
And does very regularly. And I think that the thing with Richie as well, the idea of this being a dirty little secret, is, first of all, it's internalized fear, it's internalized homophobia, it's internalized shame and resistance to acknowledging this part of himself, none of which are good things. And I don't think the film for a moment is saying that they are good things or are okay things. This is a symptom of the damage that has been done to him and a symptom of everything that he's been through. And I think if you see it as that, again, you know, it's not good, it's not comfortable viewing, it's not the right way to think about things, but it is a symptom of a guy who is thinking about things the wrong way because of everything he's been through, I think.
Also, the idea that Richie doesn't come out overtly at the end of the film, certainly not to his friends, maybe to himself he does as well. But you should let people come out on their own terms, at their own pace, on their own schedule.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, that's where Richie is. He's not quite ready at the end of the movie, if indeed he is gay.
I do think things are changing that way. I do think things are getting better that way, but you're right. I mean, it's still, you know, there are still people who are scared to talk about it nowadays, and that's with the taboos having fallen and fallen and fallen since the 80s. I always think it's interesting that, you know, this is a book that was set in the 50s and 80s, and so many of those 80s stories have a 50s feel because they were all nostalgic about their makers' childhoods, essentially. And so many 80s movies, you know, not just Back to the Future, but so many of them have just a 50s kind of tinge, you know, in the music. There's all that kind of nostalgia. And we're now getting that same nostalgia for the 80s and even into the 90s. We're always kind of a generation removed, it feels like. And so I thought that the updating of the story was actually quite cleverly done and kind of, in this case, depressing in how far we haven't really come.
Yeah, absolutely. We have another question. This is actually, it pertains to that. It's from Out of Sights on Twitter. There's been so much talk about the opening hate crime scene. Yes, like the last 5 minutes, in fact. It's a brutal scene, but I found this strange in understanding why and how Pennywise was involved other than taking a bite out of the dying boy. Do you think he was more involved in causing the crime? Perhaps Pennywise had some sort of possession over the homophobic group of guys like he did with Henry Bowers?
Yeah.
I mean, Pennywise is a symbol. Obviously, he is the supernatural bad guy here, but even in the first film, he is a symbol. Every single member of the Losers Club, whether it's Bev and her abusive dad, whether it's Eddie and his mum and her sort of Munchausen by proxy, sort of she's...
Hypochondria,
she kind of pushes that onto him, whether it's Bill's trauma over the death of his brother, which obviously is, in air quotes, caused by Pennywise. But Pennywise is there as a symbol of these existing things in society that are evil and bad and a way of interpreting those. So I think on a literal level, Pennywise chomps him from the river, but the attack... is an evil in society that is sort of heightened by Pennywise's presence. I don't think Pennywise affects that whatsoever. I don't think they're being possessed by Pennywise. I think he pops up when there is sort of an evil in society that was already existing.
It's opportunistic, I think, in his part.
There is an element, though, of this corruption throughout Derry, that the proximity to him is like... living in proximity to smog or something, that you like, you breathe it in and you're more likely to have asthma because you live in this smoggy area. You're more likely to be a freaking psycho because you live in this Pennywise corrupted area. And maybe I think there's an element of suggesting in certainly Bev's case and maybe in Bill's as well, you're more likely to carry the scars of that with you and to attract, you know, non-positive people into your life. God, this sounds a bit woo-woo, but you know, I feel like
healthy
people tend to find other healthy people, and damaged people sometimes, and this is a horrendous side effect of the damage that they've and the trauma they've been through, seem to replicate that damage and that trauma, and it's a horrific thing that people have to work through and get through. But
you get locked into a cycle,
exactly. Yeah. And I think they are locked into that cycle. Certainly, Bev is when we see her.
But there's also a really interesting thread about the fact that the Losers Club cannot remember the past, but the past manifests itself in their various life choices as well. It's not just Bill's wife looks a little bit like Bev. Eddie effectively marries his mum.
I think the same actress, actually.
The same actress?
I think so.
That's cool. Bev effectively marries her father, you know, and they're just doomed to repeat.
Ben seems to be alone. He seems to be very, you know, his life is now very controlled. His life is now very clean and very, very absy, but but also kind of remote from everyone else. He's literally teleconferencing into his own meeting at the beginning. You know, he's just kind of isolated. And again, that seems, and to an extent, Richie, I think that fits that model as well. Mm. They're a little bit apart from everyone else. Mm. And again, yeah, it's the same issue.
We have another question from at Blakeney Sam, who asks, like the first film, it has an over-reliance on massively telegraphed jump scares. Well, they worked for the people in my screening. However, there were a couple of creepy standout moments. Which moment played in your mind the most post-screening? Mine is still Mrs. Kirsch's weird pause mid-sentence.
I love how long they eke that out. Just the timing of that. I think Muschietti is really good at the timing of those horror beats. I agree that there are sort of telegraphed jump scare moments. It's a mainstream horror movie. That's kind of what they do a lot of the time. I don't think it too often breaks that rule of like, here's a loud sound that's non-diegetic. That's the sort of jump scare rule, that if it's a sound within the universe, if they build attention by it's quiet and someone's creeping around and then there's a big bang because something's fallen over and that makes you jump, it's fair game. But if it's just a on the soundtrack, not fair game necessarily. And I think he tends to stick to the fair game jump scares. But I think he's got a really great sense of timing of where you place the camera, what you can see, what and the character can't see, drawing your eye to certain kind of places. I love that shot where Bev, I think, is looking at the picture of the Pennywise dad in the house, and in the background you see Mrs. Kirsch's really like jerky walk in the background along the in the doorway. I think stuff like that is just those little moments for me more than the big crazy stuff is what sort of has stuck with me.
I like the big crazy stuff. I like the images of the big crazy stuff and the imagery of the big crazy stuff, although it didn't scare me. I don't know how much of it actually scared me. I jumped out of my seat a few times. That's for sure. The Paul Bunyan statue with its demon face made me jump. That's for sure. I'll hold my hands up. You got me. But in terms of unsettling me, the Mrs. Kirsch sequence for sure unsettled me.
I think that was the most effective sequence of the entire thing. The moment I remember it is actually the door, the not scary at all door, and they open it up and it's a tiny, adorable puppy that is obviously about to be scary, but they wait just one or two beats longer than I thought they would.
Yeah.
And that freaked me out. I was like, it's going to be scary, it's going to be scary, it's going to be scary. Why hasn't it been scary yet? Oh my God, it's going to be scary and it still hasn't been scary. Why is this taking so long?
That's one of the things I think this film does well, which is marry comedy and horror. And having Bill Hader helps an awful lot with that. He speaks to the audience an awful lot in a lot of those scenes, not least down to that thing line, you got to be fucking kidding me. James Ranson, as well as Eddie, is really, really good at puncturing the tension of a scene also. Because everyone else, because Bill and Ben, the Flower Pot Men, everyone's taking it seriously. And Mike especially has been haunted by this because he has chosen to stay behind. And so he's closer in a way to the psychopathy and the dark influence of Pennywise. Maybe that's why he invests so much in the Ritual of Chud, even though he knows that it isn't really going to work. Maybe there's something there. But Eddie and Richie are really, really funny. But the sequence that I thought worked best in terms of that blend of comedy and horror and being unsettling is a scene that doesn't have Pennywise in it at all, which is Bowers stabbing Eddie through the cheek.
Oh, yeah.
Because that is really scary, but also really, really funny. And there are these little odd things, and a lot of them revolve around Eddie and Richie. The scene where Eddie goes down to the basement of
the pharmacy,
and the evil creature that attacks him pukes on him, and then it plays Angel of the Morning for like 3 seconds as it pukes this oil over him. And I didn't get a chance to ask Andy and Barbara about it, and I really wish I had. But what the fuck was going on there?
You mentioned earlier Evil Dead 2, and it felt quite Sam Raimi-ish, very sort of like the monster's going to come right up to you and puke in your face and stick its tongue in your face.
Yeah.
And it's very physical. It's the physical movement of comedy and horror at the same time, that you're laughing but you're also kind of tense at the same time. I think that felt like his sort of little Raimi tribute there.
It's great as well, but I also wonder if the scene with Bowers stabbing Eddie and then Eddie stabbing Bowers, and that's really funny as well, especially when Eddie stumbles out and he's like, Bowers in the bathroom. That's really funny. But I think one of the reasons why it's effective as well, why it's creepy, is that this is something that can actually hurt the Losers Club.
Yes.
Bowers can actually hurt the Losers Club in a way that Pennywise can't, because the movie very early on establishes that Pennywise has no domain over them, mostly, until, of course, the end when he does. But all those scenes, as effective as they are, if everyone confronting their childhood fears. For example, I thought the flashback to young Ben with Bev, where she is actually Pennywise, I thought that was a pretty effective,
that was
pretty,
really upsetting.
Pretty damn spooky as well. But by and large, there's no jeopardy in those scenes. Like, you know, as much as this great visual of watching Richie watch Pennywise float over his head, attached to a bunch of balloons, or, you know, as much as Bill confronting Pennywise in the sewer, you know that nothing's going to happen to them because Pennywise has no control over them. So I wonder if that's a...
I never really felt that, even though I've been told it, I never really felt it. But that is, again, because I'm a big scaredy cat, which we should never forget when discussing horror movies. It's a weird distinction. And I think it's something, again, Stephen King does very well. Like, a lot of his books will combine this supernatural or whatever threat with something mundane, with just a bad person. And I think the bad people in his books are often almost scarier than the terrifying monster or whatever, Ace in The Body and Stand By Me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you know that guy. You know that that guy is a town bully, and you know that he preys on anybody he decides to, and that exists in the world. It's the same reason that the attack at the beginning of this is so terrifying, because they're real people.
And even in the first chapter as well, where Henry Bowers starts carving letters into Ben's stomach, because that feels very distinct to the sort of horrible things that Pennywise is doing, in a way that's kind of more real and more visceral. As much as Pennywise is chomping people's arms off and pulling them into the sewers, Henry with the knife on the bridge is kind of scarier for me.
Because you can't close your eyes and make him go away. That's
very tangible.
Yeah, he's there. He is absolutely there. That's a big thing in King, actually. He does it. There's a recurring motif of through a lot of his books where the evil force, for whatever reason, can't manifest itself or can't hurt people directly. So it has to employ people or possess people. I mean, obviously, Jack Torrance in The Shining is an evil avatar.
Needful Things. The entire town goes freaking batshit because of things.
Yeah, it's a certain recurring motif.
They're fantastic,
Ben. Here's another question from @Bruby_Chris. Do you think they spent too much time on the flashbacks with the kids and not enough time establishing the losers as the adults?
I did think there was more of the kids than I expected, and I was very happy to see them because they were, as I said, phenomenal performances, phenomenal actors, and they really established those characters in the first one. But I do think there were a couple of times where we could have done with more of the adult losers, because I think Bill, Ben, and Bev were a little bit shortchanged in how much we saw of their lives as adults and how much we got to know them as adults. I mean, I'm surprised actually by how little James McAvoy had to do, relatively speaking.
Yeah, because Bill for me was always the lead of the book.
Yeah,
he's the king surrogate in obvious ways. So,
and he doesn't get quite as much to do here. And so I kind of agree with that question. I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to give up the kids stuff, but I would have done with more of those people as adults.
I mean, yeah, speaking as somebody who prefers the sort of generally the kid-centric stuff in this story to the adult stuff, for me, I actually could have had less kid stuff in here. I think partly it's a symptom of they approached it and said, right, we're going to do chapter one is all the sort of first timeline, and then we'll do the second film as the second timeline. And then when they were making the second film, it was like, oh, we need to have direct echoes of things that we actually haven't done yet with the kids. So we need to do sort of new versions. They obviously have to put in about Stanley's sort of shower cap in the little, and in fact, they didn't even mention the bunker. It's like they have to go back and plant some more seeds that they didn't get a chance to plant first time around. And then when you have an echo to something that you've literally only just seen, it feels like a lot.
Less earned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very much that I would have loved to have seen more of the adult stuff. And in fact, I think there's a much longer version of this movie, and I could have tolerated watching that much longer version. For example, the love triangle between Bill, Ben, and Bev, such as it is, that for me could have stood to have a little bit more.
Me too.
Because I feel that Ben's memory comes back very, very quickly. His declaration of love for Ben.
Bev.
Ben's declaration of love for Ben. Bev. It's just like fucking Clint Booth all over again, isn't it? Ben's declaration of love for Bev seems to, well, not come out of nowhere, but you're also wondering, have you not fallen in love with anybody in the last 27 years? I mean, look at you, for the love of God. I mean, seriously, are we meant to believe that there no lady has floated your paper boat in the last three decades?
I mean, I guess he must have been really working hard in his architecture and not going out, because...
The architecture of his body?
I was referring to his job. How dare you, sir?
I'm sure he's had a lot of very impressive erections over the years. Buildings, guys.
Obviously,
buildings.
Chris. Obviously.
Obviously, that's a technical term in the construction industry. Anyway, I'm not sure it was given enough, really, to hit home. There's like this brief bit where she begins to think that maybe Bill's mm-hmm. got a torch for her, but it's never really established whether Bill does have a torch, is carrying a torch for her.
It looked
there were
moments where I was like, oh, it's because I couldn't quite remember the book, and I was kind of remembering the book as Bill and Bev. Right.
Yeah.
Because I probably shipped them when I read it. That's
the term the kids use. Yeah.
Kids.
I was writing Pennywise and Eddie fanfic, but you were going for Bill and Bev.
I was shipping Bill and Bev. But actually, it does make, obviously it makes more sense that the two less married people would maybe hook up.
Yeah.
But also, it does seem that it's the nice guy who finishes first in this case. The nicest guy. The nicest, most cuddly and non-threatening guy.
Absolutely. And that's hope, of course, that when it comes to matters of the bedroom, he doesn't finish first.
Okay. I feel like we're getting into maybe a bit too much detail about their life together, but sure, cool.
Is that what It Chapter 3 is going to be? Just a relationship drama between Ben and Bev?
Oh, why not?
Would watch.
Pennywise can be the counsellor. He would be a terrible counsellor.
By the way, if you can hear some drilling in the background, it's not Bev and Ben. it's some workmen. We're having something built next to the studio here. Which,
a mighty erection.
Yes. Right now, there are four or five burly men beavering away on a mighty erection. And it's somewhat off-putting, but hopefully we can all get past it. I've completely lost my point. Right. Not for the first time. At Lenny UK DJ asks, for the It Chapter 2 episode, is there enough footage in both chapters to put together a complete faithful adaptation of the novel, or is there stuff missing to make that impossible? Would you watch it if it was edited together?
Mm. I might watch them back to back. I'm not sure I need the intercut edit, to be honest. But yeah, I'd be happy to do an afternoon of these.
Yeah, I'd watch them back to back. Like you say, I'm not fussed about him taking chunks from each bit, especially as we said before, they had to go back and do stuff in chapter two to then do the echo. Although I guess that could be satisfying. Like we were saying,
yeah, that's true.
That there, maybe some of those echoes don't feel as earned because you've only just seen the original version before the 27 years later echo. So if some of that stuff was put back into chapter one, I don't know, that could be potentially interesting. I mean,
but the book plays the two time periods more mixed up, doesn't it? Flicking back and forth. And actually, I thought it was really effective, the basic decision that they made when adapting it this time to just split up the two time periods, I thought was just a phenomenally good decision. Mm-hmm. And I'm not 100% sure I want to see the book structure. I think it works on the page. I'm not sure I want to see it again.
Yeah, agreed. That's the point I was trying to make as well. I was halfway through that before the guy started drilling about, even growing up, even reading this book, I preferred the adult characters. I don't know why. I should have related more closely to the characters who were closer to my age when I read this book, because I was reading Stephen King stuff a little earlier than I perhaps should have been. But I always grabbed on to the adult version of these characters. And so I would have liked to have seen actors of this caliber maybe given an entire movie to show us a few tricks. But at the same time, it also gives us an insight into Stan a little bit. And there's some lovely bits, that flashback to Stan at his bar mitzvah. I thought that was really, really lovely. And Stan is one of the things that when you split the movie in this way, kids and adults, by doing so, Stan becomes underserved, really, out of all the characters, naturally, because he's the one who takes... he takes the early train out of the story. But I thought this movie made him important. The fact that it made his the memory of him was important to Richie coming back. Mm-hmm. That was important, I thought, and really nicely handled.
Yeah, and I think it gave weight to his choice and almost made it feel more of a sacrifice and less of a escape, I think.
Mm. Yeah, that scene kind of, yeah, broke my heart a bit at the start of the film. Again, not knowing where these characters were going to go in the second half. And I felt like it was very sort of empathetic towards him and quite sensitively handled. And just really tragic. And especially he is the member of the Losers Club, I guess, aside from Bill, obviously, who loses Georgie, who is sort of physically harmed the most by Pennywise in chapter one. I think Pennywise sort of chomps on his head. He has those, and he still has the scars on his face when he's slightly older, because I think, it gets his massive jaws kind of over the front of his face.
Maybe that's why he remembers Pennywise a little bit more than the other guys.
He carries the physical trauma as well as the emotional trauma. And I just thought it was a really, very emotional way for that sort of character thread to go, that he doesn't want to go back. That's sort of the start of the film, but it also bookends the film because you have his letter at the end explaining his choice to the other losers. And I think it kind of needs it in that moment where obviously they've defeated Pennywise and you have a sort of relief over that, but not just Eddie's death, but Stan's death coming back as sort of the awful loss and tragedy that has happened across the course of this whole story.
I think it also is one of the things I've always loved about this story and other stories like it, in King's Over, which the Stand is very much like this as well. And it's ultimately about friendship. It's about companionship. It's about people who are noble and people who have good hearts coming together to defeat the evil. Mm-hmm. And Pennywise in this movie can be a metaphor for any number of evils that you want to mention in the world today. This terrifying orange-haired, almost weirdly fascistic evil guy running around the place. But enough about the current president of the United States.
Hey.
But, Pennywise can represent pretty much anything. But this movie is ultimately about defeating that evil, whatever it may be, defeating it by coming together and showing love and compassion and kindness. And I know it's really, really hokey. I know it's really hokey to believe that those values can defeat can defeat the opposite values. But I'm okay with a little hokey.
Mm. I believe that kindness is important. I'm with Paddington and Stephen King on this one.
If we're kind and polite, the world will be right.
You know what? It's true. And I think that is the big, I think that's what makes the scary bits in this film for a coward like me very bearable, is because you're trusting in goodness to win the day. And that's always a good thing.
All right. I've just got a couple of last questions for you guys before we leave. One, the little kid that Bill has encounters with and Richie has an encounter with. It's a very, very funny encounter when Richie does it. But the one that Pennywise kills in the Maze of Mirrors, is that kid real?
Ooh. I mean, I hope not, because if not, he died a horrible death for no real reason. That was weird to me. I, not having gone back to the book, when you saw that scene in the trailer, I thought that was going to be Bill's kid. I thought it was going to be his son who was at risk. So, because he seemed obviously desperate to rescue him. But of course, it's a stand-in for his brother. He is the great unsung victim of this, if he is real, that's for sure. So maybe that makes sense.
And the girl in the bleachers as well.
Oh,
I think he maybe
yeah.
is real, because you do yeah. see Pennywise feeding on other people. But I guess the main thing is that it's real to Bill, that his ultimate fear that Pennywise is feeding from is his lack of ability to save the kids. And when he's confronted with that, actually, for me, that was one of my favourite set pieces in the film. Just generally, the
mirrors?
The heading into the fun house, then into the Hall of Mirrors, and then the real creepiness of Pennywise just repeatedly smashing his head into the glass, it was like a very, felt more visceral than some of the other sort of scary moments in the film. And just like a, yeah, horrible, creepy sort of image with a tragic ending as well for that little kid.
Yeah. I'll be honest, I'm sorry, I think he's dead.
You think he's dead?
Yeah. I think he's real.
Does he seem to disappear completely?
No, well, don't we next see Bill just running away?
Mm.
Understandably. Okay.
Because we established that he's real, because Richie thinks he's a phantom, but he isn't. Mm-hmm. And then obviously he appears to Bill later on. But yeah, I did wonder whether, yeah, is it real? Sucks to be that kid.
Mm.
The other one, under the bleachers, does feel a little bit like Pennywise hasn't killed enough people in this movie, guys. We need a scene where Pennywise kills people. Well, we can't have him kill any of the Losers Club because they're quite important. Oh, okay, well, just
kill a small and adorable child.
Yeah, there you go. Have that. Munch away. Do you think that the casting of the kids to the adults here, I mean, that's just freaky, isn't it?
It's crazy. I mean, especially James Ransone as Eddie, as the grown-up Eddie. Like, that for me is like the most uncanny. Obviously, Bill Hader is great, and there's sort of him and Finn Wolfhard is like a great match. But James Ransone and Jack Dylan Grazer, that is the one that really confounds me. And the just all the little mannerisms and things are carried over so eerily well that I think that would be incredible watching them back to back on a rewatch. Because obviously, I think you can tell here that they had to do the de aging stuff on Finn Wolfhard. Because if you've seen him in Stranger Things lately, he is not that little.
He's now 20 feet tall with a beard.
he's massive. He's massive and he's gangly. And he doesn't have that little round face anymore.
Jack Dylan Grazer had pretty obvious de aging as well in the bunker scene. Just didn't look, had a quite slightly artificial sheen to his face.
I think some of the Ben stuff did as well. I think quite a few, I think especially the boys, like, probably shot up quite a bit since then. Whereas I guess we've seen Sophia Lillis in Sharp Objects. Between these and I think, I don't think they had to do any de-aging stuff
on her. Didn't look quite as much. I mean, I still think she looks more like Amy Adams than Jessica Chastain, but I mean, it's picking hairs. I actually thought the most stunning to me was Chosen Jacobs and Isaiah Mustafa as Mike. Something about, I mean, they're not that similar in face shape, but just something about their features made me think, well, of course, yeah, that kid is going to grow up to look like that guy, obviously. That just fits. It's something about them just, I thought, was perfect casting. And again, that same kind of calmness and quietness and stillness that Mike has, in contrast to, obviously, like a Richie or an Eddie.
I'm glad Mike gets more to do, I think, in this movie as well. Because he's kind of sidelined.
He gets a really great hideout as well. Like, who doesn't want to live in a tower on top of a library? God, the dream.
The dream, unless you're in Derry.
Unless you're in Derry, Maine.
Then it's the nightmare.
Yeah, that's true. Mm. That's true.
Also, you get a bit more of an expansion of his stuff as a kid, obviously. So I think in chapter one, you see one of the visions he sees is the people trapped in the building. But I'm not sure you get all the details. I think there was something in this about like a newspaper headline that was about like a crack den sort of thing, that was like, that felt like a something that wasn't present in the last one, but it, I don't know, it's just something that made that even more sort of nightmarish, this horrible image of his parents dying in that fire. Because I'm not even sure in the last one, is it established that those are his parents?
Yeah,
I thought it was.
Is it?
Yeah.
Maybe it is. Yeah. Maybe it is. But yeah, I thought, as somebody who doesn't know the book or hasn't seen the other miniseries, it feels like that character is the one that has less to do, but I think they still embellished bits of him through the story.
Indeed. Finally, Pennywise himself. What do we make of Bill Skarsgård in this movie? Do we think he got enough to do? Was he suitably spooky?
Oh, he's scary, man. I think, you know, it's a difficult problem with this chapter of It in particular, that you do have a lot of full-on batshit monster shit at the end, which is only going to be CG or crazy, crazy, you know, prosthetics and set dressing. So I think they did better than I feared with that. I thought it might go completely off the rails at the end, and I don't think it quite did. I think they kept that on the track. But I think, yeah, Bill Skarsgård brings a lot to that role. There's just his expressions are terrifying.
That scene where he's painting his face. Seeing sort of Pennywise stripped down is also kind of horrifying, and a really great reminder of how much he brings to the physicality of that part. I agree. I think there's been some criticisms that a lot of the Pennywise stuff is maybe a little bit too CGI enhanced because he is so good on his own. I love that he can do the eye looking in the wrong direction thing on his own, like that he can actually do that with his eyes, which is really amazing. Spooky. And yeah, the scene where he paints his face and he does his hands down his face and the red appears. Oh, yeah, that he's great. He's great. Mm.
So we think we're done now, right, with this series, because now there's been murmurs that they think there might be enough for a third movie.
There have been rumors of a prequel or something. So what's 27 years before 87? 62? That's possible.
80, wouldn't it?
Before 89, it'd be.
62.
So
which is
maybe something like that, something earlier, something around the turn of the century, even when there was the giant disaster that's mentioned a couple of times.
It's when Dr. No came out, so I'd be bang up for Sean Connery versus Pennywise. That'd be brilliant.
Well, good luck with that one, Chris. I don't think it's going to happen, but, you know, hey, who knows? It might be interesting. I'm just not sure, again, with all prequels, what conclusion you can really come to. I guess escape for the protagonists or death. Those are the only
cake
real
or death,
outcomes.
I think, is also a really good choice.
Cake or death.
I would personally choose cake.
I would go for cake as well. I think they should leave it there. I know it's going to be tough as well because they're going to have, you know, this one did really well, the box office over the weekend. Not as well as the first one, but hey.
Still well, yeah.
Still very, very well. And so they're going to have like 600 million reasons to make a third movie. But I think they should leave well alone.
Do you know what they should do? Salem's Lot. That's what they should do.
They should do Salem's Lot.
Yeah. If you think this is a good idea, they should do Salem's Lot instead, which is vampires.
I think they are.
I know, yeah. but like bigger, but like more so, but like.
Because from what I understand as well, Pennywise then enters other bits of the Kingiverse. So I would be quite up for them doing other Stephen King things on a big scale. And if Bill Skarsgård popped up in.
Derry is a regular feature. Mm-hmm. It featured in 11/22/63, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. He spends some time in Derry and finds it a really depressing and dark place. Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, 62. That's what's happening in Derry in 62. Thank you. Well done, Helen.
That's what's happening up then. Yeah.
Yeah. So it'll be earlier.
Yeah, Pennywise is part of all the King books are connected, and the Dark Tower is the text that binds them all, and it's really metatextual.
Joe Hill's books are also connected, by the way. That's Stephen King's son, one of them.
Any particular reason that you should be doing that? Like, just stop ripping off another author's work, Joe Hill.
God.
Honestly.
Well, they did write a piece together, so obviously that's why.
Who died and made you Stephen King's successor? Oh, God, I hope Stephen King doesn't die now.
Oh, God, no. But, so his Nosferatu books, which are phenomenal, are kind of linked in a little bit to this one. But
speaking of LinkedIn, hit me up on LinkedIn. Pennywise has recommended me as a podcast host, which is nice. Thanks a lot, Pennywise. And check us out on Twitter and whatnot, because I'm bringing this to an end. In case you weren't aware what I was doing, I'm bringing this to an end because that is it for our It Chapter 2 spoiler special. Our next spoiler special will be No Idea.
Ooh, I love No Idea.
No Idea. Who knows what it'll be?
Who knows? Well, there's some exciting films out in the rest of this year, and you can have a look at those and probably guess some ones that we'll be trying to spoiler.
Yep, we'll be trying to spoiler. Mm. Can't guarantee we'll spoiler them, but you never know.
Never know.
Right, that is it. Regular podcast goes out every Friday. If you don't already listen and subscribe, if you could, that'd be absolutely amazing. Do leave us nice reviews on iTunes as well. But that is it for our It Chapter 2 spoiler special. And it's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ben Travis.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to lend Ben my It miniseries Blu-ray. You're going to enjoy it, Ben. It comes attached with a couple of red balloons, but just ignore that.
Spooky.
Just standard.
We all float down here, you know.
We all float. Does anyone else fancy coming to check out Ben Hanscom's Magnificent Erection?
Oh, I mean, I love architecture, so that would be great.
Architecture? Thanks for listening. See you later. Bye.